Israel launches airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip amid tensions over a march by settlers in occupied Jerusalem outwards. 20 people have been killed and 3 district centers have fallen in fighting between Afghan security forces and Taliban militants in the past 24 hours. And Peru's socialist candidate Pedro Castillo claims victory in the presidential election, but his right-wing rival pledges to fight the result. Our top story for this half hour: Israel has carried out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, hitting Palestinian targets there. Tel Aviv claims the air raids were in response to Palestinian fighters sending incendiary balloons into the south of Israel. No casualties have been reported. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli attacks are a failed attempt to undermine solidarity between the movement and Jerusalem al-Quds. The strikes were the first to hit Gaza following Israel's 11-day aggression against the Palestinian territory last month. That conflict ended on May the 21st after a ceasefire. Nearly 260 Palestinians, half of them women and children, were killed. Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response, killing a dozen people. While Israeli forces attack Palestinians protesting against a march by Israeli settlers in occupied East Jerusalem on foot. The Palestinian Red Crescent said 33 people were injured during the clashes. Regime forces also arrested several Palestinians who were demonstrating against the so-called March of the Flags. Moreover, Israeli forces blocked Palestinians' access to the Damascus Gate, leading to the Old City, and pushed them away from the area. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements in the Gaza Strip had warned they would respond firmly to any provocative acts by the settlers. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya had sounded the alarm about dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event. Palestinian human rights lawyer Jonathan Kutab said the settlers' parade is so provocative that some Israelis advised against holding it this year.
Well, this is actually a recurring event that occurs several times, usually once a year. It celebrates the conquest of Jerusalem. And it's a very right-wing, racist celebration, insisting that Jerusalem is just for Jews. And it's usually done in a very provocative way, going through the Old City, through the Muslim quarters, through the areas where Palestinians usually live, basically to tell them, we won, we are the masters of this place, and you are worth nothing. In fact, it is so provocative that the Israeli police recommended that it be canceled this year, or that it take place in a different location and not in the Arab sectors and the Muslim sectors of the city. But unfortunately, they decided to do it there anyway.
A military exercise involving Italy, the U.S., the U.K., and Israel is wrapped up in southern Italy. The drills were aimed at enhancing combat readiness and strengthening bonds between allies and partners in view of potential conflict in West Asia. Our correspondent Max Civili has a report on that.
A military exercise on the Italian soil involving the United States, Israel, Italy, and the United Kingdom has caused much of a stir in Italy, with a number of lawmakers demanding the foreign and defense ministers to explain in parliament the extent of the operation. The 12-day exercise, dubbed Falcon Strike 21, led by the Italian Air Force, took place at the Amendola Air Base near Capitanata, a small village in the south of Italy. It involved multilateral training drills which aimed to boost the combat capability of Israeli F-35 fighter jet pilots.
Preoccupazione la mia, ma quella anche.
My concern and the concern of many citizens who witnessed the military drills is over the high level of satisfaction expressed by representatives of the Israeli army. They overtly declared that the exercise was aimed at training Israeli fighter jet pilots for upcoming conflicts in the Middle East involving airstrikes on Iran. This is no conspiracy theory. The Times of Israel has published such remarks made by military officials.
Some Italian lawmakers have also argued that it is unacceptable that the same Israeli F-35 fighter jets which hit the Gaza Strip in mid-May were used in the military exercise. They say the Italian government's engagement in providing weapons or military training to Israel contravenes the country's constitutional principles and laws.
The Israeli Air Force repeatedly bombarded the Gaza Strip last month in its debut use of F-35 fighter jets made by U.S. Lockheed Martin. The regime's continued air and artillery bombardment claimed the lives of nearly 250 Palestinians, including 67 children, in the besieged enclave.
We don't want our country to provide arms or military know-how that could be used by Israel in a military attack, or that our country gets involved in a military conflict. It's against our constitution. It's unacceptable that the fighter jets used by Israel to bombard Palestine were on the Italian soil.
In May, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed deep shock at Israel's continued air and artillery bombardments of the Gaza Strip. Guterres said, "If there is a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza." Max Civili, Rome.
Well, Iran has hit back at Western nations for adopting what it calls a politicized approach towards its regional activities and missile program. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the Islamic Republic is an anchor of peace and security in West Asia. Saeed Khatibzadeh says this is while the West has, quote, a disastrous record in this region. Khatibzadeh has advised NATO and G7 leaders to abide by international law instead of lecturing Iran. During a summit this week in Belgium, the Western Military Alliance urged Iran to stop all ballistic missile activities. NATO members further condemned Iran's influence in the region. The leaders of the world's seven industrialized nations took a similar stance at their meeting in southwest England over the weekend. At least 20 people have been killed in fighting between government forces and Taliban militants across Afghanistan over the past 24 hours. Afghan authorities say the Taliban have taken control of three districts in the mentioned period. That increases to 10 the number of districts that the militants have taken in the past 3 days. The fighting comes as the government and the Taliban are engaged in talks to bring lasting peace to Afghanistan. On Tuesday, they began fresh negotiations in Qatar after talks stalled in April. Amid the peace efforts, violence has surged in Afghanistan. In the latest incident, unknown gunmen killed 4 vaccination workers and injured several others in Nangarhar province in the east. An Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats is in Islamabad under what is known as the Track to Diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any sign of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group. Correspondent Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 Diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s. And there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
International rights groups criticized Saudi Arabia for executing a Shia man on charges related to an anti-government protest when he was a minor. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Now, Saudi Arabia has come under fire by international rights groups for executing a Shia man for crimes he allegedly committed when he was a minor. Amnesty International said that Mustafa Hashim al-Darwish was a victim of Riyadh's deeply flawed justice system. Anti-death penalty group Reprieve branded the Saudi act as a human rights crisis and said that Mustafa's family was not notified prior to his killing. Both groups, as well as Mustafa himself, said the confession used for his sentencing was obtained under duress. Man was arrested in 2015. He was charged for taking part in protests in Saudi Arabia's eastern province in 2011 and 2012. Saudi authorities handled the protests by the country's Shia minority with a very heavy-handed crackdown. In 2019, the overwhelming majority of executions in the Arab Kingdom was comprised of Shia people. Joining us now for this news review is Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East affairs expert from Madison, Wisconsin, and Mr. Colin Covell, former lecturer at the University of Bahrain, joining us from Bluefield. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Mr. Covell, we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts on this latest execution in the kingdom.
The Syrian Mustafa Hashim al-Darwish was executed today by the Saudi monarchy, 6 years after his arrest for the 2015 protest of the illegitimacy of the House of Saud and its undemocratic rule. And at the time, Darwish was 17. So Saudi Arabia has killed someone who at the time of his crime was a child. They just kept him in jail, waited till they thought the world would accept his death, and then they killed him. And what did they kill him for, Mr. Arya? For protesting. So in Saudi Arabia, if you protest the illegitimate regime, you will have a death sentence on you.
Thank you, Professor Covell. And Mr. Kevin Barrett, welcome to the program. It's very controversial. You are you're a kingdom. You're sentencing teenagers to death, some as early as 14 or 15 years old. A couple of years later, you carry out those death sentences. I don't know how far a due process goes in all of this, but your initial thoughts on this, please.
Well, there's no due process in Saudi Arabia, no fair trials. This practice of executing protesters is par for the course. Saudi Arabia has, of course, said that they've ratcheted down their execution. executions. But I think what they mean is that they're maybe executing fewer murderers and executing more protesters. And so they claim also that they're not executing minors anymore, but they just did. They just executed Mustafa Darwish, who was 17 at the time of the protests for which he was arrested and charged, but not even given anything remotely like a trial. And the kingdom is playing on some kind of strategic ambiguity here, claiming that, well, we don't really know. You know, he may have committed some crimes when he was older than 17, too, although there are no details about that, because the problem is that he didn't commit any crimes. The problem is he's just a protester, and he's not actually getting any due process. So they can say anything they want. They can make up anything they want. They can claim that even after he was arrested, that somehow he committed crimes, because there's no record. There's no judicial record of anything that he was clearly charged with. His lawyer was not given a chance to actually defend him. And so the whole thing is completely non-transparent. And that's par for the course in Saudi Arabia, one of the very worst human rights abusing regimes in the entire world and in the region.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program and your input. Kevin Barrett from Madison, Wisconsin, Mr. Professor Colin Covell, they're joining us out of Bluefield.
Peruvian socialist candidate Pedro Castillo has claimed victory in the presidential runoff held on June the 6th. Castillo hailed his victory on Twitter, clinging to a narrow lead over his right-wing rival Keiko Fujimori. Vote counting has ended, but official results have not been announced yet. Fujimori has rejected her rival's claim of victory. She has made allegations of fraud with little proof. Fujimori has told supporters that she will keep fighting to defend Peru's democracy. The South American country is currently struggling with an economic recession triggered by the pandemic. That's a wrap for now. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight. For years, civil rights groups and academics have raised alarm at the way U.S. Republican officials have deployed false claims of voter fraud as a political strategy to justify laws that restrict access to the ballot. We're prepared for you an article written by Sam Levine under the heading How U.S. Republicans Came to Embrace the Big Lie of a Stolen Election. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. days after the polls closed in Florida's 2018 general election, Rick Scott, the then state's governor, held a press conference outside the governor's mansion and made a stunning accusation. Rick Scott was running for a U.S. Senate seat, and as more votes were counted, his lead was dwindling. Targeting two of the state's most Democratic-leaning counties, Rick Scott said there was rampant fraud. Directing the state's law enforcement agency to investigate, he said, "Every person in Florida knows exactly what is happening. Their goal is to mysteriously keep finding more votes until the election turns out the way they want." He added, "I will not sit idly by while unethical liberals try to steal this election from the great people of Florida." Rick Scott eventually won the election, and his comments eventually faded away. But the episode offered an alarming glimpse of the direction the Republican Party was turning. A little over 2 years later, fanned repeatedly by Donald Trump throughout 2020, the myth of a stolen American election has shifted from a fringe idea to one being embraced by the Republican Party. The so-called big lie, the idea that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, has transformed from a tactical strategy to a guiding ideology. For years, civil rights groups and academics have raised alarm at the way Republican officials have deployed false claims of voter fraud as a political strategy to justify laws that restrict access to the ballot. But they say the way Republicans have embraced the myth of a stolen election since Donald Trump's loss in last November is new, marking a dangerous turn from generalized allegations of fraud to refusing to accept the legitimacy of elections. Supporting the idea of a stolen election has become a new kind of litmus test for Republican office holders. Republican election officials in Georgia and Nevada, who have stood up for the integrity of the 2020 election results, have been denounced by their fellow Republicans. Republican lawmakers across the United States have made pilgrimages to visit and champion an unprecedented inquiry into ballots in Arizona, which experts see as a thinly veiled effort to undermine confidence in the election. 147 Republicans in the U.S. House voted to overturn the results of last November's election, absent any evidence of voter fraud, and after government officials said the 2020 election was the most secure in American history. Richard Hassan, a law professor at the University of California at Irvine, who studied election rules, said, "Voter suppression is not new. The battle lines have been drawn over that for quite some time, but this new concern about election subversion is really worrisome." The willingness to deny election results comes amid heightened concern that Republicans are maneuvering to take over offices that would empower them to block the winners of elections from being seated. Several Republicans who have embraced the idea that the election was stolen are running to serve as secretaries of state, the chief election official in many places, a perch from which it would exert enormous power over elections, including the power to hold up certifying races. Edward Foley, a law professor at The Ohio State University, who has written extensively about the history of contested elections in the United States, said, "I do think it's a relatively new phenomena, unfortunately, and disturbing," adding, "We've had disputed elections in the past, but we've never had the denial of the basic mathematical reality of counting votes." The effort to undermine the election result appears to be working. according to a May Reuters Ipsos poll, a majority of Republicans and a quarter of all Americans believe Donald Trump is the true president. The same opinion poll showed 61% of Republicans believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Ron Bishop, the chairman of the local Republican Party in Fond du Lac County in Wisconsin, said it was damaging to have such widespread uncertainty about the result of elections and was generally supportive of efforts to restore confidence. But he noted his dismay that Republicans continue to push lies about the election. He noted that the Republican Party of Waukesha County, a bastion of GOP voters, recently hosted a screening of a film backed by Mike Lindell, a Trump ally and prominent election conspiracist, that pushed false claims of election fraud. He said, "We need to win back those suburban Republican voters that Waukesha County used to turn out, not keep poking them in the eye by forcing down their throat more of this election stuff, Trump stuff they don't want to hear." He added, "I don't know why it's so hard for Republican elected officials to tell the base the truth. That would help." Alexander Kasar, a Harvard historian who studied elections, noted that there was a long history in America of using fraud as an excuse to push back on gains in enfranchisement among blacks and other minority groups. Data shows white voters are becoming a smaller share of the U.S. electorate. He said, "There are definitely echoes of this now," adding, "There has always been an inclination to see new voters of different ethnicities or appearance as agents or unwitting agents of fraud." Max Stepanovich, a longtime Republican operative in Florida who is now retired, said the lies about the election provided a kind of cover for those unable to concede they were a shrinking minority in the population. He said, "In the past, party elders, party leaders, exploited the crazies in order to win elections, and then largely ignored them after the elections." He added, "What has happened since then is that Donald Trump opened the Pandora's box and let them out. He not only let them out, he affirmed them and provoked them. And so now they're running wild and they're legitimizing these delusions." While there have been other nastily contested elections in U.S. history, President Rutherford B. Hayes was labeled Rutherfraud, and his fraudulency after the contested election in 1876, both Kasar and Foley said it was difficult to find a comparison to what was happening now. Foley added, "We've never had that. We've never had McCarthyism-style fabrication of a conspiracy theory applied to the process of counting votes. I would say it's especially dangerous when it's the electoral process." He added, "Because it's the electoral process that ultimately allows for self-government. When the mechanisms of self-government kind of get taken over by a kind of McCarthyism, that's very troubling."
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Israeli far-right groups have marched in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian protesters have also gathered at the venue of the so-called March of the Flags, which marks the anniversary of Israel's 1967 occupation of the city's eastern sector. Tel Aviv's annexation of East Jerusalem al Quds during the six-day 1967 war has never been recognized by most of the international community. Israeli forces have cordoned off roads leading to Damascus Gate in the city and arrested a number of Palestinians on the steps of the gate leading to the old city. Now, is this supposed to end up in violence? Stay tuned to Press TV and watch us discuss aspects of the issue with our experts. Let's get an update first. Let's go to Akiva Ramallah. Mona Candel is there. Mona, over to you. What's going on there?
Well, despite the metal barriers that were erected by the Israeli police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds Old Town, and in the streets leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, however, Palestinians, thousands of them, succeeded to reach Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate, and demonstrated their protested in order to prevent thousands of Israeli settlers who were taking part in Jerusalem flag march. Clashes erupted between the Israeli police who were protecting the settlers. According to paramedics, 33 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces. 17 others were detained by the Israeli soldiers during the clashes that erupted in the Bab al-Amud area. Palestinians sent a clear message that even the Jerusalem flag march, and despite the strict measures, and we are speaking about over 2,000 more Israeli police officers that were deployed in the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to protect the settlers' march. However, Palestinians succeeded to reach there and to send a clear message that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, will always be a Palestinian, and that Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islamic, and they will continue to defend it. Israeli forces closed Arab and Palestinian shops in the old town. The streets that around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, like Al-Misrara, Bab al-Sahira, as well as Sultan streets, were completely closed by the Israeli soldiers. The route of the march was changed a lot by the Israeli forces. However, the Israeli settlers did not enter the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the gate of Bab al-Amud was completely closed. The settlers didn't enter the Bab al-Amud gate in order to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they marched and celebrated and sang and danced in the complex of Bab al-Amud. However, Palestinians, elderly women, youths were there to confront them despite the strict measures and despite the attack by the Israeli forces who were protecting the settlers. Experts said that that was a challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet in case they, for the last moment, they were expecting that the Israeli cabinet would end this protest or would change completely the route of this march, especially after the warnings from the Hamas movement that sent a warning to the Israeli cabinet that if the settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, they would bear the consequences.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Mona Candel Ramallah. Now, joining me in this debate tonight will be Palestinian activists Amal Watan in Ramallah and also professor of media practice and philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Farrell in London. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Akiva Ramallah. Amal, what does this day back in 1967 remind the Palestinians about?
Yes, in 1967, of course, Israeli occupation occupied the rest of Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And for them, in this Jerusalem Day march, they're trying to show off that they were able to unify Jerusalem under the control of the Israeli occupation. And for us Palestinians, it was a Nakba at that time, Nakba in 1948, and it's continued. This Nakba is continuing until now, while the Israeli occupation still seizing our land and killing our people and seizing Gaza. So the Nakba for us continues. And this march today and the show of illusional victory, let's say, that they were able to go on with their flag parade shows that they have been defeated, because Jerusalem has turned into a military barracks. 20,000 soldiers and policemen were spread in Jaffa Gate and in the streets leading to the Old City of Jerusalem. The Old City of Jerusalem has turned also into military barracks. They closed all shops, Palestinian shops, and they forced the owners to go to their homes. So the whole city was turned into curfew for the Palestinians, but it was full of soldiers. The marchers themselves, they counted for 22,000 or 23,000, but the rest of them were Israeli policemen and soldiers. So this show, of course, shows that the Israelis were defeated today as well, because the Palestinians were demonstrating in all streets leading to the Old City of Jerusalem. And that's there right. were as well confrontations in several areas. So they think that they succeeded in this flag parade, but at the same time, the Palestinians showed their will as well.
All right, now let me ask Professor Farrow, is this the right time for the Israelis to hold such a controversial rally? It's only weeks since the truce has stopped the Israeli deadly aggression on Palestinian lands.
Well, I think, as we've seen before, there's a pattern of provocation in situations like this, and that's part of the way that the Israelis have handled the situation externally. We've heard about the military suppression internally. But of course, Israel depends on its position in terms of the international reflection of the actions that it takes. And so it has considered this, and it's allowed this to go ahead. It's created the situation. We have to, of course, repeat the fact that Israel is a settler state. It's a violent occupation, and Palestinians have suffered violence since 1948, and that violence is physical, mental, cultural, and economic. And actions like today, and incidents like today, act towards a kind of humiliation, an attempt to humiliation of the Palestinians. And we know that since 1948, there has been resistance and always been a fight for the right of return. So when people take a position, when Palestinians take a position against Israeli aggressions, every time they do that, they're part of a long history of resistance to occupation. Now, there's always been a political battle for Palestine in the international world, and this is about ideas, about representation, rhetoric, and images. These are all issues. But I think what's happened recently, there's been a shift, there's been a change in favor of Palestine and the Palestinians. And I think this has happened because there was a shift around the notion of Israel as an apartheid state, which has been happening over the past 10 to 15 years. We had the boycotts of Israeli goods, and the notion that Israel and South Africa are similar entities. And this is something which has gained a kind of traction internationally. We know that in every situation, there's always a battle for the hearts and minds of people, mm-hmm. and media is a very, very important part of that. We saw this in Vietnam, for example, where the Americans, we know, lost the war. And I think there is that kind of feeling at the moment, particularly in young people, who all of a sudden have suddenly gained an interest in Palestine. And we've seen it internationally across the world. The TikTok generation are really completely involved and interested in the situation of Palestine. And this is something which is reaching millions and millions of people, over 300 million people on TikTok talking about Palestine, debating Palestine, and showing concern for Palestine. And I think so whatever happens on the ground in Al-Quds or in Gaza or in the rest of the occupied territories, in Palestine as a whole, is feeding into a much bigger debate, and that debate is really quite radical compared to what we've had over recent years. Okay. Young people are saying that they don't believe in the Oslo Accord, that the Oslo Accord is dead. They're not even believing in the two-state solution. And I think this is a great shift in recent political kind of debates that we've seen, which the media is very importantly feeding into. And of course, that's why Palestinian media is being suppressed today by Israeli authorities. We know that there's been a huge clampdown because they do not want images of suppression to be beamed across the world because they know that's a losing battle.
Okay. Now, Amel, the new government in Tel Aviv has lent full back into the holding of the March of Flags in this sensitive juncture. It seems that a new prime minister doesn't care much about how the Palestinians feel about this occasion. Let's have your take.
Of course, I think both governments, the former and the current government, they don't care. They come actually from the same roots. They're both ultra-Zionist, ultra-racist, ultra-Nazis. So both government leaders of the former and the current governments are extremists. So they don't give or they don't care about the Palestinian lives. They don't care. The only notion that they care about is the Zionist ideology, which is seizing the whole lands of the Palestinians. And that's what we are currently going through inside Jerusalem and the surrounding neighborhoods of Jerusalem, like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods, seizing more and more houses and ordering demolishing of houses, of more houses. 638 houses are to be demolished in Silwan. This is ethnic cleansing. So the policy of ethnic cleansing continues since 1948 up until now. Now the Palestinians own only 10% to 12% of their land, while the Israelis are seizing most of the land. It is an apartheid state, and world opinion has changed gradually until last month, when they were more convinced that this apartheid state has to be stopped, that has to be dismantled. If we want to reach peace and security and prosperity in this region and for the whole world as well, this apartheid state must be dismantled, and a new state should be, one democratic state should be established on its places where we can have a normal life in this region. This apartheid state actually poses a threat to the whole region and internationally as well. We can see that they are outreach as Africa or Eastern Europe. So the ramification of the existence of this colonial apartheid regime in this area is posing danger to the whole world.
Right.
Nonetheless, the region and Palestinians as well.
Okay. Kenneth, you know that Tel Aviv has put the air defense batteries on high alert and fearing rocket fire from the Palestinian side. Do you expect an escalation? And if that happens, how violent would it be this time around?
Well, I think the violence is there. The violence has never gone away. We can't really talk about escalation because on a daily basis, Palestinians are suffering and they're dying. And so in the way the framing of this in the media, particularly in some elements of the Western media, is as if these are just small explosions that happen and it's just a matter of getting the two sides together. That depiction is an entire lie. It's been a lie since 1948 and it's never stopped. And I think we have to get away from this notion that, you know, it's just a question of something happens and then there's a reaction and then another reaction. This has to be part of the analysis of the situation, the analysis of the creation of the state of Israel as an apartheid state, the function of its state, how it works internationally, how it relates economically to the United States. This is what we need to consider. Because if we're constantly going to be dealing with day-to-day aggressions and reactions, and whether that reaction is internal to Palestine whether that's international, we're never going to move away from a circle of discussions and discussions. And I think that the shift towards the recognition by governments now, who are beginning to listen to their people, you know, things only change when people move. That's the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen recently in terms of the issue of Palestine is that there's been a move from great sections of the international community, an interest in Palestine, and a determination to support Palestine. We also have to recognize the role of refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were forced from their land violently in 1948 onwards and had to go as refugees across the world. And they've settled in those countries. And those, the children of that generation are growing up and asking questions like, why can't I go home? They're in a position of power. They may be filmmakers, they may be models, they may be scientists. They are part of those societies, whether it's in Canada, the United States, or Europe. And now they're using their power to explain to the world that they are not satisfied with what's happened. They want the right to return. Their families want the right to return. And so the debate, I think, has to be shifted away from the violence. The violence has to stop. There should be intervention. There should be international intervention in the violence which Israel is using against the Palestinians. And this is long and long overdue. We all know that the reason this has been allowed, permitted, and actually encouraged is the United States and its need to control the Middle East for its own economic purposes.
Okay.
So this is the bigger picture.
Okay,
and
if
I
you
think
allow me, we have only 1 minute left. Let me put one last question to Amel. Amel, with Naftali Bennett assuming the post of prime minister in the Tel Aviv regime, would you expect to see change in the Israeli policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians? We have only 1 minute.
No, of course not. As I said, the former and current governments are the same. They were in the same party, actually. They're part of the Likud party. So nothing is going to change for us. And the fact that four elections occurred in 2 years shows a lot, shows that this whole state is descending or is in a descending phase. The internal problems that they have, even within the right-wing Zionist parties, is incredible and is affecting the rest of their own people. So the demography is working against them. Palestinians in all of Palestine, historic Palestine, are exceeding in numbers. They're uniting together. The new generation of 1948, together with the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, are in one but fighting and resisting this
okay.
occupation in all means. The resistance in Gaza and the axis of resistance, actually, in the whole region, are supporting the Palestinians. The international free people. Are also
okay.
on our side. So
unfortunately, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. Sorry for
the course of history
all the
is
time.
Very.
Okay, and that's with that, we should, I should appreciate the contribution made by our guest. We had Palestinian activist Samal Watan and Ramallah, professor of media practice and philosophy with Covent University, Kenneth Ferrell in London, with their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafina.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam urged the Muslims to feel pity for the orphan and to have affection for the weak. He, peace be upon him, said, "Whoever has four qualities, Allah will build a house for him in the garden. The one who shelters the orphan, has mercy on the weak, feels compassion for his parents, and treats his servant gently."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the very beautiful conversations and dialogues of the infallible imams, the divinely appointed imams, that they talk about a whole host and a whole variety of things. One of the things that they talk about are Islamic social etiquettes. They talk about how to behave with one another, the appropriate and the proper way of being a perfect human being. In one of these golden conversations, we find that Imam al-Baqir also talks about how a human being should be, how a good Muslim should act, how a perfect human being will look like. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir talks about specifically the qualities of the Shia, the followers of Islam, the followers of the Holy Prophet, the followers of the divinely appointed Imams. Imam al-Baqir says that these true Shias, our true Shias, are humble and they are pious. They pay back the trust and they praise Allah very much. Dear friends, these are three very important things. Sometimes, though, we seem to look them over. We don't really pay attention to them. Of course, the first one was that they are humble and pious. They're not arrogant. They're not pompous. They're not in your face. They don't consider themselves to be better than others. No, they are humble. They are pious. They are aware that Allah hears everything, that Allah sees everything, that Allah surely knows what is hidden in the hearts of mankind. And so these Shia, they are humble and they are pious, but by no means are they weak. They are strong, they are resolute, they are determined, they have strong willpower to uphold truth and justice and to oppose arrogance and tyranny and oppression. The second thing, dear friends, is that the Shia of the Ahl al-Bayt, the household of the Holy Prophet, they pay back the trust. Meaning, if somebody gives us a trust, somebody puts something in our trust, in our care, whether it's money or some kind of object, or even put us in care of somebody's family, somebody's property, we repay back that trust. We pay back that trust. We are honest and trustworthy, and we do not take advantage of this trust which we have been given. And finally, they praise Allah very much. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. All praise belongs to Allah. Subhanallah. Glory be to Allah. MashaAllah. InshaAllah. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. They praise Allah very much. Beautiful qualities, beautiful characteristics brought to us in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza.